Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive's Employee of the Month, 2 months in a row. Leave a message at the...
Hi, Jamie. It's me, Jamie. I just had a new idea for our song about the Name Your Price tool. So when it's like, tell us what you want to pay, hey, 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 and the trombone goes, blah, 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 and you say, we'll help you find coverage options to fit your budget. Then we just all do finger snaps while a choir goes, savings coming at ya, savings coming at ya. Yes? No? Maybe? Anyway, see you at practice tonight. I got new lyrics for the rap break.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Total Celebrity Show's Just Two Choices celebrity segment. You could check me out in all these different places at neilhaley.com, and I'm excited to welcome to the program. First of all, my co-host, Just Two Choices, Rico Rakoski. Rico, how are you, man? I know you're excited about our guest today.
Oh, absolutely. No, God vibes to you as well, and today's guest is awesome. He's a 2016 inductee in baseball into the Missouri Sports Hall of Fame, where he keeps really good company with other great Missouri Hall of Famers like baseball's Yogi Berra, Stan the Man Musial, and basketball's great Bill Bradley, and NASCAR great Rusty Wallace. And he's a pitcher for the Kansas City Royals and St. Louis Cardinals, and he still holds the Cardinals' single-season record for the most strikeouts by relief pitcher of 120, and he's also author of the book On the Eighth Day God Made Baseball, the famed major league pitcher Mark Patel. Mark, how you doing? Congratulations on all your successes. Great to have you.
Rico, Neil, I'm just really glad to be here. I'm out in Arizona. I'm enjoying the weather right now. I don't know if you're on the East Coast, West Coast, or wherever, but it's a little bit warm out here right now.
Go, Rico.
Oh, I say we're kind of a combination. I'm up in Colorado, and he's out in Pittsburgh. So kind of got the country covered now.
There you go.
All right.
There you go.
You know, Mark, you're from a very small town in southeast Missouri. In fact, one of my best friends is from up there, from Sykeston, just up the road from Gideon. And I saw in your recent 2016 induction into the Missouri Hall of Fame, you mentioned how it was the American League Baseball. You know, you're from a small town. You know, mm-hmm. when you were in high school, they gave you this great opportunity to compete in baseball, and yet it was mm-hmm. hard to find coaches that could teach much about pitching. So before we talk about all your other great stats and stuff, especially since mm-hmm. it sounds like you're in Arizona, probably coaching, what kind of an impact did that lack of pitching coaching growing up in small southeast Missouri there have on you and the golden gems of wisdom that you now give to the kids today and you give to young players today about pitching that you didn't have then?
Well, yeah, I did grow up in Gideon. It was a small town. We were cotton and soybeans. It's in the Boot Hill. And the Boot Hill is that little part that hangs down into Arkansas, and it's mm-hmm. the part that Arkansas did not want. But to get back to your question about the pitching aspect of this whole thing is that it was hard to find anybody that would to give you, you know, legitimate answers. I know it's a little more techie today, and I'm not old school, even though I'm older. I coached mm-hmm. for 20 years professionally, and mm-hmm. I've just been removed from the game only about 10 years from a professional status now. But I've got a pretty good look at some of the amateur kids and how mm-hmm. they operate, and it's way different than what I came out of, because I signed out of high school when I was 18 and in 1971. And so you're talking, quite a while here in difference. But, you know, back then it was just basically throw the ball over the plate, throw the ball hard, you know, let's get it out. And, you know, about the mechanics, there wasn't too much on that. You know, I'd ask the guy, well, how's my mechanics? Oh, you're throwing really good. You know, keep on throwing well. You know, that's not it. you can't really say that nowadays. You know, you got to point to the kids. The kids are a little bit smarter too. You know, and they want an answer like I did. They want the answer, and mm-hmm. you hope the only thing you hope is that they have the passion and the drive when you're talking to them.
Mm-hmm. So do you have a golden gem or something that's in the forefront of your mind that you just now hold on to, and like a first piece of advice or something like that that's in the forefront of your mind with the younger players back then?
Well, the biggest thing back then is, you know, you're always told, you know, work hard, work hard, work hard. I would say work smart. you know, okay. I mean, you're going to get your running in and all that. But, you know, I think a lot of people think, you know, throw the ball hard means, mm-hmm. you know, every pitch is going to be thrown hard. And that's not true. That's not pitching. And I know today they're more in tune with trying to get velocity. And that seems to be the big deal. So you're kind of more or less more of a thrower than you are of a pitcher. Mm-hmm. In a sense, if you look at Catfish Hunter and Maddox, for instance, those two are just standout pitchers. And, you know, pitching and throwing have one thing in common. They have the same amount of letters in both words, and that's pretty much where it stops. So, but it's you know, there's a lot of difference, you know, in the art of pitching. I mean, but I mean, anybody can throw a grenade up there and let it blow up, for instance. But, you know, you throw it in the nitro zone, it's going to get hit. So try to keep mm-hmm. it down and teach a little bit about location as well. And how to get it down there. I mean, just don't say, mm-hmm. oh, well, you got to get – here's what a lot of people say. They'll say, oh, you got to get the ball down, but they don't know how to tell you how to get the ball down.
Strength.
You know, it's interesting when you talk about that, Mark, you know, how, again, you were kind of naturally – learning pitching then pretty much, right? It was more about your talent basis based on all the different expertise that's involved now and how they train pitchers at a very young age, right, Mark? You had that gift, didn't you, of a pitcher in certain ways?
I was blessed with a God-given arm, and the one thing about it is that, you know, I think everybody wants to seem to have their own little cue spot to where they say, well, this is the way to do it. And mm-hmm. you've got, you know, all the weighted balls, you've got throw 200-300 feet out, you've got this and this and this, this and this. And these kids aren't made like that nowadays. They're tech kids. The strongest part of these kids nowadays are their thumbs. You know, they're on Xbox all day. And then you go out and you throw a second baseman with a right fielder who's got a better arm, and he's throwing two or 300 feet out, and everybody says, "Well," and the next day the kid's arm's sore. Well, you wonder why, you know, and they're thinking more is better, and that's not true. I mean, everybody's got a different plan and a different situation when they walk onto a baseball field, and you've got to tailor it just a little bit differently. So it's a baseball-specific experience when you go to throw a baseball or attempt to try a pitch. And, you know, I think it's so funny sometimes. I mean, in a bullpen, a guy can sit up inside and outside to a pitcher that is a little bit in tune, and I said a little bit in tune, to throwing. If you put that hitter in the box, though, his little stinkster gets – puckers up, so everything starts to go, the ball starts to wander then, you know, so you know, there are issues. So, you know, there's a lot of different types of fear. There's plenty of straight fear, there's fear of success and fear of failure, and I operate under fear of failure. I didn't want to fail my teammates. So, I mean, we have to actually teach ourselves, because coaches can't teach us everything either. You know, most coaches say, well, you got to listen to me, and this is the right way to do this. No, there's a lot of ways to skin a cat. So you've got to keep your ears open. You've got, as a coach, you just can't say, well, I taught this, so my grandfather said this, and my great-grandfather said this, and my old uncle said this, and my aunt said this, and you're going to listen to them. So, and that's about the way it is sometimes in coaching. But you've got to open up and actually learn a little bit.
Well, you know, as you talk about that kind of stuff, Mark, an idea that pops into my mind is, could you share this thought? I mean, maybe it doesn't exist, but it seems as if there are some recognizable general categories of fear. I mean, your point's really well taken. You're pitching in the bullpen, pressure's off, you get out into the, you know, you get up on the mound, and all of a sudden, a switch flips, you know, is it fear of failure? Is it, I mean, do you find like there's maybe three or four categories you could share in general that would explain some of the fears that are on the mound?
I was a closer mainly. And uh-huh. I started, and one year I got in 300 plus innings at age 20. And that's after that, I had my first arm surgery. But, that was after winter bonds, and then I went to Big Red Camp. But, if you look at a starter's IQ is basically around 100 to 110. You know, a closer's IQ is about 3 to 5 IQ. So guys like me, we don't know where we are. In about 3 minutes, we know the game's going to be over, though. if we're from the set down, I win. We win the game. Oh, we win. Okay, so that's about the way it is.
Wow. So basically, you're saying the fear is different between a starter and a closer.
There is no fear. They don't even know where in the hell they are. we're on a baseball field having a blast. Why are the sands all filled up? who's the chick over there on the above the third base dugout? You call George Fred over, and if you look over my left shoulder, look at that. Oh my gosh, that's unreal. You guys think we talk baseball out there between the lines.
See,
there's no way we talk baseball.
See, that's a great point, Mark, you made about talking about certain times there could be fear and they're not fear. Every night you came to the ballpark not knowing when you were the closer, if you were going to work or not work. You know, just so and in times when they overuse you in that time period, they would say, okay, you pitched too many innings today. So and especially playing for teams that were good teams, not always needed a closer. A lot of guys went longer, right? So you just had to be prepared every day.
Yeah, to earn a save back then, you had to go three innings. Everybody said, well, you only got 16 saves, but you got pitcher of the year. Well, you had to go three innings to get a save.
Right.
That was the deal. And then if you throw over 100 innings, no closer today throws over 100 innings. So, I am sure that probably did cut my arm, my career a little bit short, because I was not ready to take a baseball and run with it. I mean, if you look at my statistics, I'm not trying to say anything about them, but you can tell my good years, my bad years from my arm surgery. It's pretty funny to sit there and look at them, though, but there's a distinct difference. And, your odds are just to relax between the lines. That's the biggest thing as a coach I try to do is I try to get the kids to learn to relax. They've got enough on top of them already, especially when they step up to the plate, they're tense. When the pitchers are out there, they're tense. And I said, just throw the ball through the middle down and let the hitter get himself out. Because the hitter will get himself out if you give him the opportunity. So the opportunity is to throw the ball through the middle of the plate and let it run.
Well, in your coaching, as you're seeing different young players now, let's just say early on you say, oh, there's a closer. Right there, and there's a starter. I mean, does the role switch at some point where some kids sometimes, as they mature, they move into the starter position, or do you pretty much get into one groove or the other?
No, that's a good question because you have late bloomers, a lot of kids get overlooked by high school coaches. And they'll say, oh, well, he's not going to really perform for me. But, that kid's going to go to college over the kid that's 14 and shady, And he tops out as a sophomore, and that's where he stays. And right. They still try to make him top of the heap as a junior and senior, and it's just not working. So you need to develop those late bloomers and recognize those late bloomer kids that, have little peach fuzz on them and they don't shave until they're about 19. So they're out there. So you can't give up on them. You can't give up. And you can't give up on the left-handed pitcher because you can't throw the ball over. It takes about a year and a half longer for a left-hander to develop. It really does.
And Mark, how valuable is that left-hander? How valuable is that left-hander, in your opinion?
Well, if you find a left-hander that can throw the ball over a ball over the plate, you better sign him. because this is not medium that can really truly do that. And left on left is hard to find because they're like up, out, over, ball three, strike one, ball four type guys. But if you see that guy that's actually got it nailed down, and has learned to focus, has learned to relax and focus at the same time, you're going to get some nice results. And that's the one thing in my book I put in there. My book's a real fun book to read, but it's got one area in there, and that's funny. It's called Separating Yourself from the Pack, and it was talking about visualization. I went from A ball to the big leagues, and all of a sudden, I didn't even go to big league camp. So, I mean, they said, well, who's this guy? Where'd he come from? Why was he 9-1 in AAA? And by June 9th, and we're calling him up to start against the Baltimore Orioles. Well, they had to call me up because somebody would have claimed me because I wasn't on the 40-man roster. And so they kept me up there the minimum amount of days of 30. I did well against Baltimore. The Oakland A's come in. They had won, at that time, 2 World Series. They would win 3 out of 5 years. And that's why I started against back in Kansas City, and I got beat up. And so I was not ready to win at that time. I was not ready to win. That's a pretty good term you use. I mean, there's 4A players, there's AAA players, there's 4A players, and there's big league players. You know, that 4A player is just on the verge and the cusp. He just never gets over that hump. He's not really ready to win at the big league level. So that's why they have to go back down and develop. And, that's where your character comes in. And, they've got to realize and tell themselves the truth that I've got to tell myself the truth and get this done and work on it to where I can go back, go play at the highest level. So that comes into play.
Well, you the baseball route out of high school is to the pros is, very different, than football. And, you're from way down there, like you said, and the parts of Arkansas didn't want, down by Risco and Howardville and all those big towns. And what was your route, Dave Sykeston? What was it like in high school? And I guess American Legion baseball is probably the way that the scouts come looking for you. Did you have college teams looking for you too? Or what was it back in high school at that time?
I did. And the college route was not as difficult in a sense because either you could do it or you couldn't. And the Legion I played for in Poplar Bluff and Missouri and Blytheville, Arkansas my last year.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And my brother caught me, Eric. And Eric ended up going to Mississippi State. He's a year younger than me. He got drafted twice. And he said, and I called him up out of the big leagues. And I said, hey, you got drafted. And he's pretty funny. And he said, yeah. And I said, are you going to sign? And he paused. And he says, let me tell you something. This is a bunch of crap what you do. So he already knew what he wanted to do. He said, I'm double-A tops. He said, I'm going to move on with my life. He did the right thing. And, we played 50, 60 games at either one of those American Legion places in the summer. And then in high school, that was just like not a big deal. But when Eric and I, he caught me, and he's just a year and 16 days behind me.
Okay.
He did all sorts of things. I mean, if he didn't like the way an umpire was calling a game, he pointed his mask and I'd throw a fastball in there, and he wouldn't even shoot the fastball sign down. He'd just move his hands like he was just backing up a Freightliner truck or something, and he'll bring it on. And he'd let the ball go right between his mask and his glove, and it probably hit the umpire in the mask, and they'd knock him back a couple of feet, and he'd take the mask off and just kind of wallow around on his waistband. One of those guys came up one time.
All right. Well, okay. Mark, I'm going to kind of take us back to one the question, as I know Rico has a few more, but I want to go to something that was probably one of your most challenging things in your life, and I know Rico has that same thought on this question. That was, again, the success you had with the Kansas City Royals, but that one day, that one game.
Which one was that?
that one American League Championship Series.
The one in A-ball or
the American League Championship Series, that championship game against the New York Yankees. And what were you thinking before you made that pitch and then after, and in certain ways? And how you recovered to be successful.
Before I threw the pitch, I thought it was colder than shit. And after the pitch, I said, oh, shit. So that was about the way it was.
Okay, that's good.
I'm going to get a little serious with you. Okay, what you want. Anyway. So, they had a 7-minute delay. Thanks for not being serious for a while. I know. Anyway, that's my ADD kicking in. That's why I wrote 3 books. The editors told me I could stop. I said, why is that? He said, you've written 3 books. I said, really? So they had the delay of about, 7 minutes. I'm not out there timing it or anything. But, the outfielders' backs were to me, and I could see their numbers. And, I threw like 4 or 5 warm-ups, and I turned around, and that's when I saw their numbers, and their gloves were on the side of their hips and just kind of leaning over watching this. And they were backed out from the fence because there was batteries and bottles and beer bottles and, anything thrown out there that was disruptive because George Brett had just tied it up, making it 6-6 in the 9th inning in Yankee Stadium. And so what had happened was there was that downtime, and so about 5 minutes into this, I've got my arms crossed out there. I'm kicking the dirt around, just kind of heen and hawing and stuff, and watching the antics that had went on. And so I motioned Buck out, Martinez, and Buck was catching. And I said to him, hey, let's get the hell out of here. And he says, nah. He said, they're getting it cleaned up. He said, it'll be back in here in about a minute or so. So anyway, we went back to it, everything got calmed down. And he shoots down the sign. I wind up, I throw the pitch. And it was a high fastball. It really wasn't where I wanted it at all, period. And the ball went up in the air. And the biggest thing I saw that night, though, I had that weight out there, was it was like there was low clouds coming over Yankee Stadium. I mean, you could just see white clouds that were just moving. So there's a pretty good wind up there in those clouds. And that ball was hit up pretty high when he made contact. And so I looked at it, and you got that short field porch at Yankee Stadium. And so when it went up, I said, the ball's not going to go out. It's not going to go out. And McCray was playing right, and Al Cowan was playing center. Al would have normally been right had Amos Otis not been injured. But the ball went out about two feet. And so I see Mac just lean up against the fence, with his back on the fence, and his feet, together and just kind of leaning against it. And AC, Al Cowan, was right near there.
Right.
But afterward, they said to me, my teammates were great to me, but they said, Max said, I think Al would have had a shot at catching that thing, had he been over there. And I said, I just kind of nodded my head. But, there's so many fans on the field because Cham was – made it past second, and now he found out that he was in trouble. He was trying to get back to his dugout, and somebody tried to, reach for his helmet. He took the helmet off and was running like a football player. So and, you know, knock a few people down because that's all I could do. And then I just saw a bit of that. But when the ball went out, I kind of just looked down. I looked to center field, and then I looked back down at the back end of the mound. And then I turned around, and as I put my foot on the grass, there was already people on the mound, on the dirt.
Wow.
So, because they tore the plate out, they tore the rubber out, they tore all the bases out. The bases were easy to take out, but, man, it's hellaciously hard to get home plate and the rubber out. I think.
Wow.
You have to have a bulldozer out there. But it, as you saw on the film, it was flooded with Yankee fans. And when I got over the dugout, I was kind of, nobody was there except Freddie was down there and he had his head in his hands. And then I went to the, I just kind of walked around to the left a little bit by the bat rack. And the guy took me by the arms. Hey, Mark, I'm going to take you up. I said, okay. So we went up the runway and on both sides of me were New York's finest. And so I walk in through the clubhouse door, and I toss my glove. I just toss my glove in my hat, and I walk into the shower, and you know, and just kind of put my head against the wall. And Dave Nelson and Amos Otis were real good in there, and Cisco, pitching coach, and Whitey eventually came in there, and I pulled my stuff together a little bit, 8-10 minutes later, and kind of sat down and in my locker and just answer the questions as best I could. So,
wow. And it seems like almost a shift in vibes, like what happened with the Cubs and the rain delay. You know, there's a shift in the energy. So here you guys were on this momentum, you know, and then there's this 7-minute, 8-minute pause and the energy shifts, just like the, you know, that rain delay with the Cubs. Something flipped. Yeah.
The one thing, you know, I wasn't even thinking close to home run because I had only given up one home run the whole year, and
right.
I had well over 100 innings. But and then, you know, the ball goes up, and you think the ball's not going to go out, but it did, and it kind of jolts you a little bit, you know. And then I think the biggest thing is they were thinking probably, is this kid going to bounce back for next year? You know, because that's pretty
right.
Honest.
Exactly, yeah.
And it's a big mental thing. But we opened up on the road against Detroit. I got a save in that game. It was, you know, it's colder than hell in Detroit in April. And or Kansas City, for that matter. But we opened up. I don't know. They did the schedule 3 years in advance by that husband and wife team out in Boston. They always did the scheduling back then, but they always did it 3 years in advance. And for some stupid reason, I just ironic reason, I should say, we opened up with the Yankees at home. And the very first game we played them, Splittorff came in. He got into the ninth, and I had to come in. And I think with the runner on, and I threw 4 innings of no-hit shutout ball and got the win against the Yankees that night.
Wow.
It was really interesting.
And what I think, Rico, is what Mark was able to do, overcome a lot of people that have had that adversity, Mark, have not.
Oh, yeah.
They've never come back from it. Never. You look at the stories of a lot of the people who...
Bill Blass.
Yeah, exactly. Think about just reading up on certain people and their certain thing. I think Mitch Williams never was the pitcher he was after that, was he, Mark? I don't think.
Yeah.
Think of kickers. Think
Johnny
of
Moore.
Yeah. I mean, just we could create all these names. But how did the question I want to ask, Mark, is how did you choose to go ahead and continue to have success in your life all the way, even after that adversity?
Well, I don't know. I think there was just a deep-seated intuition that I had that I wanted to be around a baseball field for a while. And I knew that there was adversity. My father was wounded in the Korean War. He got shot all to hell. And my mother was carrying me at 3 months, and my brother wasn't even born. They're buried in Arlington Cemetery, my mom and dad are. And So it was a yes or no sir type family, and he was pretty tough. You know, I mean, in a good way, he was a real lovable father, but he was tough, you know. And my mom was an RN for 53 years. So we lived out in the middle of nowhere on a farm, and you saw a lot of tough situations out there. You saw a lot of death. I've seen death, you know, out there. And I just felt like my father had made me better than what this is, just one blip here. And, you know, I let's deal with it. Wow. Just try to go. And I did. You know, I even walk into places in Kansas City and, you know, people said, I got pitcher of the year that year, which is really funny for the Royals. I mean, I had a great year. I really did. But, you know, waiters would say something. And I saw a guy fire the waiter because of what he said to me, you know. And
wow.
Another guy said this, and, you know.
You know,
although, on the other hand, to the flip side of that, I was in New York the next year, and we went into New York for the first time. I'm sitting there, and I'm going to go meet a friend that I grew up on a farm with, Carter Fletcher, and we graduated together, and he was working in New York. And he said, "Let's talk to lunch." I said, "Okay." So I went down there, and I'm kind of shaking my head because we're at the hotel. There's all these people out in front there, and I go, "Man, I don't want to go through that." And the bellman came by, and he says, "Hey, Mark, what's going on?" I said, I'm trying to catch a cab. I want to go see my buddy, and I don't want to go out in front of all that. And he says, "Hey, come here." So I follow him. I'll go around to the side. And all of a sudden, you know, we're on the side of the building over there, and he opens the door up, and he whistles really loud, and there's a cab that comes up. And I said, "Man, thanks. I really appreciate that." You know, so I get in the car, and this driver says, you know, he says, "Where do you want to go?" And I told him, he says, "Hey, you locked hotel."
Oh my! Okay, so Mark has gone really. Let's kind of fish up this. Mark has really shown again how he's able to continue to joke and laugh about one difficult thing in his life, and he made the choice to move forward to have great successes. You could have five stories about Mark, five interviews, but again, purchasing his book. But Rico has a question that we've asked many, many successful people, authors, entrepreneurs, celebrities, athletes, entertainers. So Rico, go ahead and ask that survey question. Then we're going to find out how we can purchase Mark's book and learn more about him. But go ahead, Rico.
Sure.
Okay.
If you ask a question, I just want to say, Mark, thank you. You know, thank you for your heartfelt answer. I mean, I know it's not easy to talk about, and you really demonstrate actually what the question is about, Mark. In every moment in time, all of us, no matter who we are, you know, what level of fame or non-fame that we're at, we have what we call just two choices. And so the question, you know, you're either going to make that choice for that new and better self and continuing to move that way, you're going to go back into your same old stuff. And so the question is a percentage question, and there's no right or wrong answer. But when how you look at life and perhaps how your father and your mother taught you to, if you're to give it a percentage number, what percentage of life is choice and what percentage would you say is circumstance? We've had 100%, we've had 80-20, we've had all kinds of answers on it. So there's no right or wrong answer. What percentage of life is choice and what percentage would you say circumstance?
You've got to kind of go, to me, it's kind of an 80s thing because there's always that up and down movement, you know, you have to take and play. You know, I don't think anybody can operate at 100%. So I tell my pitchers to operate at 80. Because, I mean, what are you going to go out there and blow the world apart on the mound or something? So I said, you know, learn to calm down. So, you know, operate around 80%.
So 80%, 80% choice, Mark. So where can we purchase your book? Because that's going to tell us the whole story, isn't it, Mark, in a lot of ways? But also we can Google the long story because, again, we just talk about one moment. And your career before. But your career afterwards was very successful. Your career as an entrepreneur has been successful. Yep. But tell us about the book and where we can purchase that.
Well, actually, real quick, the book starts when I'm age 6 and my dad takes me to my first game. That was the only game my mother would actually miss because she was keeping my younger brother out on the farm. But And then it goes actually to Forrest Gump's statistics, which is the end, which I have some really off the chart, stupid, funny statistics. It's not a puff your chest out book. And, you know, it's an extremely fun read. You can actually go to Amazon or Amazon Kindle and read up on it. I've got some outstanding reviews. People have been super to me, and also the people, the reporters have been very good to me about the way I wrote this.
Great.
Because I actually wrote the book. There's no co-author here. And wow. The editors got a kick out of it. It's they said it's Mark Twain's voice, and I said, well, he's a crazy asshole. We have him there, too.
I like it.
So, I mean, they tried to keep my voice, and then I kind of really do tell it like it is in a fun way. And, you know, so I just, it's all on the eighth day God made baseball, but you can go to www.marklittell, if you can spell Littell, which is littell.com, and go that route. They'll pop the book up, and you get a free chapter read that you can download. It's called Blue Angel. It's where I knock an umpire out, actually, you know, with a baseball. So, true story. Interesting. Funny. But the book moves. I've had many people tell me they started it and they didn't finish it. They finished it in one setting. They put it down. It's 253 pages.
Fantastic. You know.
Thank you, Mark.
Mark, I didn't know. Rico's the researcher. I'm the one that can ask questions all day long, interviewing people all day long. But one thing I heard was Poplar Bluff, Missouri. Okay. I wrestled in a professional wrestling minor league in Poplar Bluff, Missouri that was kind of connected with old Jerry Lawler stuff and things like that. And I worked Sykeston. I worked a lot of the little towns around in Missouri and Arkansas, Jonesboro, Paragold. We're talking Poplar Bluff, Sykeston. All those areas. I kind of hung out in those areas. So I just wanted to bring that up. That's just kind of coincidence between you and I.
Get it going, get my day going. Need a way to get my blood flowing. Fire up the grill, that's my wake up. Yeah! Give me my morning matchup.
McDonald's gets your morning going. Match up breakfast faves like a toasty sausage McMuffin with egg for $3 and the fruity sweetness of a small McCafe smoothie for just $2. Make your morning routine a little better. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal.